And I've asked to share, so that's good. Looks like I've got something coming up here.
Are you able to share now? Great. Okay. Good. We see you.
You see my slides?
We do not see your slides. We see your email. Now we see your slides.
All right. Well, I shared the whole screen, so that's good. There. Okay. Again, I am going to present some concepts and opinions. I do not have a manifesto of all hazards to advocate today, but I do want to start a conversation about how to handle multiple hazards within disaster events. And we'll sort of talk about a couple of case examples to walk you through some of my thoughts and my experiences in how to handle the multi-hazard issue. So the starting mindset, often, especially in the academic world, we will latch on to a particular subject, say the hazard, and we will then subdivide it into many different parts. Landslides, there are a couple of dozen different kinds of landslides. There are rock avalanches and debris avalanches that are nearly supersonic. And then there are soil creep and minor landslips that you kind of wait around for to actually happen, and everything in between. And there are many different species above the surface, in the water, the ones that create the tsunamis, the ones that are associated with volcanic events, and then other more typical landslides that we've experience with heavy rainfall, for instance, after fire has scarred the surface. And you get a lot of runoff and a lot of soil water infiltration, and then there's slope failure. So hazards, you know, they tend to have a community of interests, specialization that dices them into many different categories. Events have their own history. The event is the disaster, let's say the hurricane or the earthquake, et cetera. And an event will develop its own history or narrative. And the narrative may well focus on one particular part of that particular disaster and exclude a lot of other details that occurred at the same time or within the time span of the disaster. And sort of put those in the shadow. And after a while, after a few years, people don't tend to remember some of those other things that were happening during the major disaster that kicked off the entire event. And that again, is a kind of natural human characteristic, whether it's academic or otherwise. So you have two different kinds of perceptions here on how disasters and the hazards that are creating the disaster, how they interact, and how we discuss them. So I want to take a couple of examples of things that may be a little bit, you know, from left field or a bit different from the way we normally talk about some of these events. I want to talk about first just a tropical cyclone. Kind of a generic, very typical tropical cyclone in the Gulf of Mexico that makes landfall over Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Just a tropical storm, so it's not a very large system. It's on a very predictable trajectory. It's moving rather rapidly, doesn't create much of a storm surge. Does have some locally heavy rainfall up to about 15 inches in Mississippi. So there were some structures that were damaged, residences, about 300 of them were declared destroyed in the aftermath. Not a very big event on the Gulf Coast, but this particular cyclone continued its path across Kentucky and Tennessee, and it merged with a low pressure system and became an extra tropical rainmaker over the Susquehanna Valley in New York and Pennsylvania, where it became a major disaster. And more than 5,000 residences were destroyed. A lot of public infrastructure was affected, bridges and roadbed, and became a $2.5 billion major disaster, the biggest one in this particular area in the past 50 years. So you have, you know, coastal conditions that were not terribly impactful. And then you have far inland, several hundred miles in the northeast, you've got a major disaster from a tropical cyclone that merged with the low pressure front. So the question is, what happened in Texas? How many buildings were destroyed in Texas as a consequence of this event? So would anybody like to volunteer an opinion about that? What did this cyclone do in Texas? Okay, I'm going to answer the question, and you'll all recognize it. It destroyed about 1,700 residences and created $500 million worth of damage. How did that happen? Well, this was Tropical Storm Lee, and this was Labor Day of 2011. So as it was going to create all these consequences on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, et cetera, and moving up a few days later, I think about 3 days later, into the Pennsylvania and New York area, you have the, on the backside of the storm, high winds, and the Bastrop County fire complex occurred, along with several other wildfires in Deep East Texas, in the Piney Woods, things like the Bering Fire and the Bear Creek and a couple of other fires, not nearly as destructive as the Bastrop Fire. So here you have one event, and that event is a windstorm on the coastline, and then it becomes a rainstorm as it moves into the northeast. And then in the wraparound, simultaneous with the Gulf impact as a windstorm, you've got a firestorm created. One disaster with all these different hazards embedded within it, according to the geography. So consider that, multi-hazard in one event. We think about hurricanes as having sort of the typical storm surge, coastal flooding, and some wind damage, et cetera. But here's one that's a little more complex than that. And it's not all that unusual for this to occur. For instance, this year, Hurricane Kay, which affected Los Angeles after striking Mexico, created some wildfires in Oregon and Washington. So it's not that unusual or that unique an event to occur. Here's Harvey. And Harvey, we can kind of split down the middle. The red dots, the red triangles, are the wind damage reflected by property claims, insurance claims, that I got from the National Insurance Crime Bureau data set. And then the blue is the combination of the National Insurance Crime Bureau data with the NFIP data. So you have a windstorm affected side of the storm on the west, and then you have the heavy rainfall developing as you move across the Colorado River and San Bernard and into the Brazos and all the way over to the Neches and the Sabine in southeast Texas, splitting the difference in the geography east and west. So high impact, especially from the floods that we recall. In fact, almost everybody remembers the mountain of rainfall in southeast Texas, but some of the other damages from Harvey have sort of, you know, they're in the shadow now of the mountain of rain. And we forget that there were areas that were equally affected. In fact, if you look at the areas where you have damage claims per 100 household, you can see these different geographies identified in the intensity of the impacts, both in the area of the coastal bend and then as you move across into Golden Triangle in Southeast Texas area, with Houston, Galveston, Fort Bend, and that area sort of splitting the difference in between. When you we were to look at a measure of, say, the impact per 100 households, rural versus urban, et cetera, all showing up here. So again, one event, multiple hazards showing up. If we look a little deeper into Harvey, this is a really great example of, you know, how complex and compound can the hazard become during an event, where we're responding to it with different response teams going in under different conditions. So this is the petrochemical plant, the organic peroxides plant at Crosby, Texas. So this is in the area northeast of Houston, a low-lying area that was going to be flooded. You could forecast the flood coming in there. So you know you've got an initial flood wave and structures that are going to be damaged potentially. In this case, industrial structures. The flood reaches that area and tips over tanks and disturbs other storage facilities there, especially those in trailers. And that becomes a waterborne hazard. It's dispersed. In fact, you can probably see a little bit in the darkest colors of this image that there were pollutants that were released by the flood. So there's stage two of this. You go from just the flood water to flood water plus chemicals. And then the chemicals catch fire. These are peroxide chemicals, and they're prone to catch fire when they're inundated. And these did, and that fire created airborne pollutants, and the airflow, the downwind impacts of this part of the event were actually the greatest danger of this particular episode. So you move from sort of a pure flood to a flood with water pollution to a fire to an airborne pollutant that was highly toxic and caused a massive response. And I was coordinating some of the airborne efforts there, and this is one of the tasks for an RC-26 that we had a series of aircraft, Air National Guard aircraft from both Texas, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and New Mexico, who came in and flew in sequence over this area over about 4 days, almost continuously, as this was burning, in order to show what the impacts were and who was in jeopardy downwind. So this became the most serious part of this entire mini episode within Harvey, which was a flood, but which ended up being a massive industrial fire with downwind consequences because of the airborne pollutants.
Wow.
We'll talk a little bit about the complexities of these kinds of events and how hazards are all wrapped up together. I've just given a couple of examples with Tropical Storm Lee, the different geographies and the different hazards that evolved from that one disaster. And then we've looked sort of in miniature at the Arkema organic peroxides plant as being, hey, that's one location that had four different kinds of hazards from stage to stage within it. This is a slide that I developed for some presentations in Japan. The Japanese, these are Japanese equivalents using English words to identify their procedures to address a disaster and to figure out how they're going to sequence their efforts to get information to command and control and then to field teams. So they start with a trigger, and a trigger is typically a model forecast. It's the impending disaster landscape and what we anticipate would be the impacts of the disaster. They then select from that overview the geography that they think is going to be of greatest consequence. So that's the selection part of the process. That's where they're going to concentrate on getting data from either surface sensors, airborne, satellite, et cetera. They're then going to collect, which this is a stage they call process. So it's actually collect and process that data as it flows back to them and create products. And those products will be the things that are fed into their decision support and then are delivered to their national incident command, as well as the ones in the prefectures and the cities, and then out to the field teams. That's the delivery portion of it. And then there's a final portion after the event wraps up where they want to generally share all this information. The thing that I wanted to discuss with the Japanese was that the initial trigger and this simple sequence is actually something that is just repeated time and time again during the disaster in different locations. We could see different cascading parts of a disaster that create a hazard response depending upon what features are affected, or how different parts of the disaster are influenced by all the other processes that are occurring in sequence. We've had disasters that have lasted for 4 or 5 weeks in Texas. For instance, the 2015 and 2016 floods that these tend to be severe weather events, of which flooding is the major consequence, but it's not the totality of what happens during a long duration event like that. They're typically set up by a sequence of low pressure fronts that are all rain bearing, or if it's a summer event, as occurred more in the 2016 context, you have a cutoff low pressure front or a low pressure system at aloft that tends to move around between pinning high pressure systems to the east and west, and it revisits a different part of the state almost every day. And you will have embedded in that a tornado that would occur early in the event, often as occurred in 2015, the Van tornado in Van Zandt County was the first part of the severe weather sequence that occurred in 2015. So that you will have, during the passage of these low pressure fronts, or as that high level low moves around the state, you'll have a massive convective event that creates a tornado. Then you'll have the heavy rainfall. That heavy rainfall will precondition the surface for the next round of rainfall, which might be a week later. And then you will move that geography around from day to day as the different frontal systems pass over it. You'll have different events occurring over different geographies every day, which means that you also have different kinds of response occurring in each one. The areas that are being affected by flash flooding or very consequential river flooding are going to have search and clear and search and rescue activities occurring. The things that were hit 2 or 3 days previous will have early reentry occurring in those areas. And the ones that were hit a week before will have early recovery operations occurring. All of these are happening simultaneously on the same day on one of these very persistent, long duration events. So you need to consider sort of multi-hazards as they occur through the duration of one kind of event. Whereas we might think of the 2015 and 2016 events as being disasters that were purely connected to flooding. They also had a lot of wind damage. They had some hail. They had tornadoes. And all of these things were happening in a sequence. So I have one more slide here to show. to talk about other ways to look at this. And one of them that kind of makes this a little more uniform or easier to get our minds wrapped around is that we think about the preconditions of the landscape to particular hazards. And in this case, we could think about the volumetric soil moisture and how that preconditions things. This would be just one location, one particular geography. And as things get drier, we have a sequence that starts with the onset of drought, and then the drought intensifies, things get hotter, things get drier, and then we end up with first with agricultural problems, then with wildfires beginning to break out. And then finally, you've got the condition that we struggle to beat the most, which is when water systems and wells begin to fail and dry up, and the state has to come in with water resources in an emergency delivery system, which is a very arduous process to set forth. So though on the dry side, we get a sequence that is preconditioned. And then on the wet side, could start with just heavy rainfall, very localized and flash flooding. Could be in an urban landscape with a lot of impervious cover, or could be on an area such as the hill country where you have very little soil to absorb the runoff. As the water goes down through the tribs, you develop a river flood. And then if it's really intense rainfall with a lot of river flooding, you'll get the catastrophic inundation. So you get end members of what could happen on just one individual piece of turf going from wet to dry, and the preconditions for that. In some ways, I think this is a better way to look at the context of disaster and hazards than we typically start with. If we look at this more as a continuum of hazard across a landscape. So here's one more slide. So rather than sort of subdivide this into unique hazards or subsets of subdivisions of hazard, or the narrative of individual events, you really need to combine both of these as an approach to thinking about how multiple hazards would be handled. Because, and I think I've given you a couple of good examples here, many different hazards can occur within an event that may end up with just one label as being the hurricane or the flood, et cetera. And I think TDIS has an important role to play in this sort of dynamic situation, both in terms of how response might be mounted, but especially in terms of thinking about how areas are going to be impacted in different ways during the course of an event, and that it's not all one thing or another, but it's a combination. And it's that combination that is, I think, kind of difficult to approach initially, but if you split it up or if you look at it in this particular overview, you might come up with some ideas of an effective way to approach an all-hazard TDIS. So with that, I will end and entertain questions if you have them.
So, Gordon, thank you for your presentation, and I'm sorry about the sound. I think it's pretty loud here. But from what you were showing and with the multi-hazard scenarios, has there been any type of hierarchical or categorical study to layer all of those so that if there is, say, a major flood in a specific area, then there's a probability that X other thing could happen. Mm-hmm. I saw there were narratives at the bottom of some of those discussions. And I was wondering, in general about that.
I don't know of any sort of structured approach to doing that. I would turn to the Japanese because it wouldn't surprise me, given their situation as being the most disaster prone of all developed nations, that they have thought through these issues a bit more than we have potentially. And some of their disasters are so large, whether it's earthquake or tsunami or volcanic eruption or a typhoon. This is the kind of thing that I feel like they would probably have a bit more expertise at this stage in expressing than we do. I think that we should develop a comprehensive approach to this.
Thank you, and I agree. I just want to make sure, especially with the it's really easy for us to get caught up in water-based issues. I mean, from a flood to a, you know, to a chemical fire with food coming out, that's pretty crazy.
It is crazy, but it's reality as well. So we'll have to handle all of it, I suppose.
I think that's really interesting, Gordon. One of the things that kind of came to me, or a couple of things kind of came to me while you were talking about that. And one of them is this, one of the ideas that we have for TDIS is to talk about things, relationships between things. We're kind of loosely calling this level two or tier two metadata, mm-hmm. or also linked metadata.
Yes.
And so one of the ideas could be that while an event might spur, you know, might spin up resources and attention and everything, we could consider the different hazards that we've built out infrastructure and services and applications and things for. We could when an event happens, we could start to build these kind of semantic or contextual relationships between different hazards, mm-hmm. and link them with a new set of relationships that kind of covers those things that are involved in a particular event that happened. So, you know, you still think about it in terms of, like you're saying, you still have all these hazards, but a particular event in time could have any, you know, number of the hazards associated with the event. And then, you know, you would be able to link those by association through the constructs of the linked metadata.
Now, I like that as an idea of how to make it more adaptive. Mm-hmm. As events evolve, some things are rather unpredictable, as we can see.
Yeah. I think also that kind of helps with the idea of context too. Like we always talk about trying to capture the context of an event, and when we put blinders on and we look just, you know, at the mountain of precipitation or whatever, you know, we get wrapped up in trying to make sure that we've captured all the information about that. But if we go back to this idea where we do look at the fact that it is multi-hazard, any particular event has the potential to be multi-hazard, then it might help us, you know, keep in mind that broader context for the event and how it did affect things like the fires or the other, you know, the other disasters that occurred during Harvey. Or events, not events, hazards.
I like that. During the course of these events, when you're embedded in it, you get a pretty good understanding that there are these multiple things happening simultaneously or nearly simultaneously. 2 or 3 years later, when people go back and recall the event, then it becomes more of a black and white. It doesn't have that sort of context and depth that occurred during the actuality of the event, that sort of sequence of decisions that have to be made within a very narrowly defined decision window, and that have all sorts of other sort of individualistic components to them. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so important to make a really comprehensive or the best possible record that we can of these disasters as they occur, so that we can go back and do the forensics and see some of the subtleties of these events and the areas where they presented something that was highly unexpected.
I see a couple of people with their hands up. Let's go with Lydia first and then Kay.
Yeah, so I one of the things that I thought was really interesting from my perspective, which is kind of thinking about the data management and data kind of long-term gathering is two things. One, it's going to be really interesting to figure out a way to create a flexible categorization system that marries hazard and event, you know, in one thing and isn't, like you said, too black and white or kind of captures all of that complexity and interconnectedness. So that's really interesting to me. But the other thing I was thinking about is the importance of gathering data on things like drought that are preconditions and maybe not identified as a hazard by themselves, but obviously have massive implications for doing predictive modeling for these events. Like, you know, making sure that we're keeping in mind that we need to be collecting data that's not just about a specific event, but also all of the things that kind of led to that event. So anyway, those are two things that jumped out to me. I think it's really helpful to hear from you and think about it in this way.
You know, the drought is a really interesting issue. I've been on the Drought Preparedness Council for a dozen years, maybe 15 years, a long time. And, you know, there's some very standard ways of looking at drought through the U.S. Drought Monitor and some of the climatological data sets that are constantly being gathered. But we're in an exciting time now that there's some new tools that can be applied, some observational tools, both from networks of soil moisture in situ, which is becoming more feasible to do inexpensively, but also through some of the satellite detections, the microwave detections of soil moisture, at least in areas that are not too heavily covered by vegetation. And all of that needs to be sort of minded as a data set that can be used subsequent to some of these disasters to go back and see, you know, what was the tipping point that created that particular wildfire situation.
Or what made it worse, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What accelerated it? What made it worse? Were there other climatological factors, wind speeds, various other terrain situations, et cetera? But I think it all starts with this more generalized view of how does vegetation stress change from week to week? You know, that's something that we've monitored for almost 20 years here at Center for Space Research, looking at the vegetation greenness and how that changes during drought conditions, et cetera. That works very well when you look at it in terms of measured soil moisture deficits, and in some ways shows you more subtle details about where crops or where rangeland is being more affected than you would tend to say just based upon the precipitation alone. We have another hand?
Yes, Kay, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that this is a big challenge because one of the issues that we're running into with the state plan, as a mitigation plan, for example, with the NCEI data that we're using, is that it is an event database. And yes, a lot of that event database is tied, even if it's an event, it's tied to a particular hazard. And so that is how it is mapped. And as a result of that, we're going to be seeing areas where we should have a lot of coastal storm because it is classified as a hurricane. We're not getting a lot of the damages from the, we're missing some of the wind damage or missing some of the water related losses as a result of that. So the challenge goes way beyond even how we see it. It's also how we collect the data. And so, and I see some really interesting comments here in the chat on how we can actually marry those together. But I would just wanted to see your thoughts on how we present this in a policy document. For example, in the state plan, hazard mitigation plan, we have hazard profiles. And in those hazard profiles, we talk about flood, fire, isolating them, and we don't particularly link them to a specific event. And we don't talk about how the data is linked together. So I think the challenge is gonna be marrying this. And I see some comments. I think Brent mentioned some, or Jamie, a tree or emergency tree or something like that. So I just want to know what other ideas you might have in terms of mm-hmm. you might have in terms of presenting this on the front end, in terms of showing yeah. the data, and also in a policy document, perhaps, how do we link this?
Mm-hmm. Now, I've worked with Tiedem several times on events that were complicated or which had pushback from FEMA for different reasons. And you might notice that when Tiedem declares an activation, they don't call it for flood in particular or for high winds, et cetera. They'll call it severe weather, and then that will be modified with flooding, et cetera, or it will be for a hurricane potentially, or a wildfire outbreak. But they have very broad categories when they activate. And when they get the presidential declaration, they don't typically cite all the major hazards that are the prime influence to the damage that's being focused on the state. They will try to get as general a description as they can that will pass muster with FEMA to get the declaration in place for reimbursement. So the other problem that happens with FEMA is for a long duration event, like the wildfires that occurred in 2011,
Uh-oh, did Gordon freeze? Is he frozen for everyone?
Yeah, he's frozen for me.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Bummer. Let's see if it reconnects. Looks like he left. Maybe he will come back in.
Yeah.
Perhaps while he's coming back, if I could ask a question, I'm not sure if folks here will be able to answer it, but I'm curious how it works on the ground for first responders and those like the data feeds that they need during an event. Is there like, are they able to get like once and hazards are kind of moving along that continuum, how does it work for those responders? Are they just kind of guessing, or are there different data sources that are stronger in some types of hazards than others? Are they able to be very like nimbly move?
It's very Wild West.
Okay.
And so typically you'll get a whole lot of well-meaning people wanting to offer up data. For many different reasons, some altruistic, some, you know, some for, you know, try to get their name out there and stuff like that. But I mean, some, maybe some both, you know, I won't be too cynical about it, but I mean, a lot of times they react in such, I mean, they're, I don't want to make it sound like it's complete chaos, but a lot of times the responders in the emergency response, and they try to, they think about each event as if it has never happened in the past. It's like a entirely singularly new and a unique thing. And a lot of times you have to kind of combat that and say, look, you know, we've used this in the past. Is it, you know, let's see if it's available. Let's kind of go, let's go through a bullet list of things that we know you, that you guys have liked to use in the past that might be helpful to you. And so there's, you know, so there's this subgroup within the response community that does recognize that there are these patterns in events and, you know, kind of a, you know, recycling of particularly useful data sets that we try to get out and develop and look for during an event to because we know they've worked well in the past.
Is that a function mostly of just kind of, you know, individual personalities who are interested in that? Or is there, I guess I'm where I'm aiming for is that, like, if we were to try to keep an eye out for who the stakeholder, a stakeholder would be who could be kind of a champion for such an effort, like, where does that tend to reside? So do we just get lucky with certain people in certain positions, or are there certain agencies that tend to be more forward thinking?
There's lots of, I mean, there are lots of, I think, ways to probably try to, you know, work with TEDM on that. And then the Emergency Management Council agencies, there's a whole bunch of those, and they all have their own kind of like niche areas that they provide data for or information about, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, potential there for collaborators or partners, or, you know, people that we could develop, like people like TxDOT, you know, would be a great source. Hey, Gordon's back.
Hey, Gordon, we were just
chatting. Sorry, I left rather abruptly, I'm afraid. And no. I'm back at a new location entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
No problem. You're in Gordon's Diner.
Jenny, this is Catherine. If you were talking about what happens during an actual response, I think we have to talk about how information flows through the State Operations Center, and Gordon would probably be best to talk about that. It's different than, like, gathering information for planning.
Right. Yeah. So perhaps I'll just repeat my question that Brent was answering. I'll repeat it for you, mm-hmm. Gordon. So I was thinking about when hazards are, or when an event is unfolding and hazards are moving from through a continuum, what is it like on the ground for the first responders and the data streams that they can use or would like to use? Is there sort of a fluid movement for them, or just based on their own kind of protocols, or what's that like in that experience for them?
So each agency and each group with their coordinators in the council room of the State Operations Center, they have a particular set of questions that each one has to answer and deliver information to the team. So often you have to work with them for a while to understand what their pressing issues are. They'll repeat again and again according to the kind of disaster you're dealing with. So you get into a rhythm of when they're going to expect a particular kind of information update and what the content of that information needs to be. And it can range from the search and rescue and search and clear teams that, you know, they need to know how close they can get to an impending impact without themselves becoming embroiled within the disaster and being pinned down in a way that they can't respond. So they also are moving night and day. So they're often looking for opportunities to rest and restore and bring in logistics and things like that. So there's a lot of on-the-fly planning that needs to be done as the boat squads and some of the aviation teams move around. So that's a completely different characteristic. You know, other agencies are primarily interested in what their facilities are going to be impacted by. Specifically, TxDOT is going to be interested in causeways, roads, bridges. How long has a roadbed been underwater? That's a critical, you know, you would think that a lot of the TxDOT damage would be from major infrastructure, but it's not. It's simply by putting several days of water on top of something that is not built to withstand that kind of flooding, a road surface, for instance, that then has to be replaced. So you're going to get a variety of questions depending upon which coordinators you're working with, which agencies, and what their response roles are.
And given that kind of variety, I guess, what lessons should we keep in mind as we're trying to develop TDIS as an all hazards system? So are there things that we should keep in mind given that variety?
I think you start with a list of what the common requests are, and especially when those requests occur. And, you know, what that embraces in terms of different hazards that may occur within the major event. Pollution is a big deal. And it's not discussed much, especially it's not discussed in a way that the media understands what's happening with a lot of the response. So that's a kind of, it's a different approach entirely from some of the other things that occur during the disaster. So when you're working with a marine or coastal pollution event, then you've got multiple agencies involved. You've got Coast Guard, EPA, TCEQ, Railroad Commission, because of production platforms and things like that. General Land Office, because of the coastal lands. So you'll be dealing with five or six different organizations.
Yeah, and it might be useful to kind of have some sort of, I don't want to call it a grade, but some sort of a distinction between those data sets that impact, you know, which bang for our buck is best for particular mm-hmm. data sets. Like, what are some of the really, really high priority data sets that everybody wants during an event, and make sure that those things are, you know, as available and as useful as they can be, because, you know, you're going to be helping the most number of people, because it keeps mm-hmm. coming up over event and event with agency and agency, right? So some way to distinguish between those kind of first among peers data sets that could get a priority as either a data service or, you know, however TDIS is going to address that.
It makes me think of Suzanne might have had to jump out already, but in the next phase of TDIS, when we are planning for moving into the multi hazards landscape, there we had sort of mapped out, okay, well, for each hazard we'll do this sort of collection exercise, right? And we have not gone into the details of what that might look like for each hazard, but it seems to me that we should combine that with something that's deliberately multi-hazard. Like, if you just approach it from all individual hazards, maybe we're recreating then how mm-hmm. you know, the siloed nature of things. So we could do something in parallel. We should consider designing something in parallel that looks at that. I imagine that would be helpful for us.
No, I agree. I think that there probably are subgroups of linked hazards that could be separated to a degree, because not everything happens during every event. Certain events are more likely to have particular linked hazards associated with them. So that would be one way to break it out into parts, make it more approachable.
Right. Okay. Catherine, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that another way to look at that is just as each hazard area is being looked at, thinking of it more as layering or being additive as opposed to being like separate silos. Because you're going to, just to divide the work up, you're going to have some focal areas. I also think using some case study examples like what Gordon did as a way to start delving into which data sets are most relevant for different hazards would be another way to make it manageable. So to take a flood event that had multiple other events and have that be how you explore what are the other data sets we need to add. And I think that in Texas, so much of it will be a flood combined with other, it's going to be an additive to flooding in a lot of events, I think, or flooding will be involved somehow in many of the events.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of goes along with some of the stuff we'd originally put in work order two, Jenny, where we were talking about the historical events. I even put it in the chat too, like the idea of being able to go back and start to look at TDIS and kind of, in, you know, we don't really want to be building the infrastructure during an event. So the only way really to do that, you know, kind of realistically and sanely is to do it with historical events. And so by going through and picking, you know, cherry picking at the start, good events that, you know, that kind of represent the way we want to model events and hazards and things like that, will give us a lot of traction and a lot of momentum in how we decide data sets and frameworks and workflows and stuff like that. Hopefully, I mean, if we do it right, hopefully we'll get a lot of insights from doing the historical, you know, looking at historical events and how we can build the context for those in TDIS.
Is there a few people we could talk to that just have, you know, like were the developers of the data products during events over the last few years? Like, because I mean, if we could start to parse out what have been the requests, then we can start to figure out that story of what are the multi-hazards and what are the specific models or data that need to be there so we can start to recommend, all right, given a flood, they want to know where the extent is.
Well, you've got Greg and Paul, and of course, Brent, who are all involved in different portions of a response for multiple disasters over the past several years. We've also, I guess we kept up our Slack channel during these events as well. We can go back and figure out when we received a request for a particular kind of product. It might have been a different kind of product than we had received a request for earlier during some other event. Go back and look at that record, and that would tell us some things, I think, about particular products that were done in conjunction with the disaster.
Yeah, I feel like that would be really useful. I could imagine after hearing you talk, especially about the multi-hazards, what immediately comes to my mind is the NFL advanced analytics, where they're like, oh, if you throw into this area, you have like a 3% chance of making the throw before they catch it, right? Like, if we already have some of that data, we can start to say probabilities of, oh, you have this probability of experiencing this, here's the model type of recommender. So I don't know. Yeah, or the Moneyball analytics. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. But yeah, I think you're on the right track.
What about a non-model based version where it's just the different divisions and things that you would need contact information for if said event occurred, where information systems, even though models are amazing, sometimes people just need practical information. Who do I contact if X thing happens?
No, it's very true, Jimmy. And in fact, neither Greg, Paul, or I do modeling. So we only do data and data creation, data services or applications or reaching out to those folks. So yeah, we've definitely taken a more of a empirical or collected data approach to hazards when we do this and not the model-based approach. I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier and that I was responding to also. It's like if we do get to the point where we can either use the, you know, the historical events. And then as we start to get new events in TDIM, as we bring more services and things online, maybe we can turn that analytical eye towards events and services and things like that. And kind of see what comes out of that, like with regards to, you know, what hazards and data are necessary. But another thing that I think that's baked into this too, is a lot of the metadata that we're creating in the level one stuff, the descriptive metadata, we're trying to collect contact information too. So even if someone may not be already online for a particular event or hazard or whatever, if we find a data set that people are asking about, maybe we can then infer by going back to the contact information and the metadata for, you know, a different data set, someone to contact to do that. So we are kind of building out that contact database as well as part of that level one metadata.
How have there been the idea of the historical archive? I see so much utility in that for a disaster information system, but I'm curious whether stakeholders themselves have called for that and identified that as something that would be really helpful. Like state agencies, have they yeah. recognized the utility of something like that?
General Land Office is the only one that's expressed anything specifically. And that really goes back 5 or 6 years ago when we were first doing some contracts with them. They were saying that these events were in the past had been just approached as unique things. And both the data and whatever projects came out of those events were done independently and were not afterwards interactive in any way. They weren't digital. They were not presented in a way that could be made interoperable. So one of the original things that we proposed is that we'll do everything in a uniform way. We'll capture the data during the event in formats that are well-structured and that we can preserve, and that through time, you would have an overlay of different disasters in the same geography. And for those events, you would have compatible digital data to examine. This was all done in a response context. This was not done for mitigation purposes or planning or anything like that. It was just, let's get some coherence on the data collection and preservation for each event as it occurs. But one thing that I have noted many times is that so much of the event data escapes pretty soon after the event occurs. Certainly within a year or two afterward, a lot of the data that the agencies were using during the event may not be available. Either it was stovepiped within the agency, or the person who was there using the data retired or went elsewhere or whatever. So if you're not collecting this in real time during the actual disaster, you may never be able to revisit what you were seeing people use during the response.
Gordon, could you give us an example of an example data set that you think GLO would be relevant in that example you gave a minute ago? I'm just trying to wrap my head around what are we talking about?
I couldn't understand quite all of that. My volume is for some reason a little low. Could you repeat that, Jenny? I can hear you for some reason better than almost everybody else.
Oh, well, that's
it's appropriate. I'm
sure. So Catherine was asking could you give some examples of data sets that you think that GLO has in mind that are particularly useful for this historical record?
When we were originally talking about this, it was a lot of the remote sensing records that we had, because we had basically all of the satellite data. And then, of course, we were directing a lot of the aviation for the still photography that was taken. And to get that into a format where it could be easily shared, both during the event, but especially thereafter. If you look at a lot of the GLO reports that came out of 2015, 2016, and certainly Harvey, is a pretty rich illustration use of those particular images and photos and things.
Did that answer your question, Catherine?
Yeah, that's helpful. I just always try to think practically, what are we talking about when we're talking about response data? I know it can be lots of things, so just trying to make it more real for myself, like what exactly is happening in the State Operations Center, what is all the data that you think is most valuable that disappears. So it's a lot of the aerial imagery being done through missions to kind of do reconnaissance on the spot that then doesn't get kept, is kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, well, that text cap or drone data, of course, that's aerial, but then the remote sensing products too. I mean, the nice thing about the remote sensing products that may not be aerial photos, they may be, you know, radar and things like that, is that you can a lot of times build lots of products out of those, you know, like tertiary or secondary products out of the raw data that comes from that too. So if you can keep licensing wise and everything else, if you can keep a hold of the actual sensor data, then you can build a lot. You have a lot more flexibility in the kinds of products you can build out of it later.
Great. Are there other questions?
I was going to just chip in a little bit of another question, but just this just reminds me a lot of a talk that I heard over at TCQ. One of the commissioners was giving a presentation, and at the time, the agency was still very much divided by air, water, waste, all these different groups, and they rarely talked to each other. And he was just trying to bring up a possible event where you could have high winds that cause the fires, which create air pollution. You bring in the air folks, and then you got floods that intends that. Then you get a flood that happens, say a few days later, and then all of that material from the fire washes into the river. I remember that was one of the things we talked about during the Bastrop fires. And then from there, that may key off a wildlife response and talking to Texas Parks and Wildlife, and then just the water supply folks and everything. But it was just, there were certainly, that was their attempt to try to get everybody together and get everybody on the same page for this. It just reminds me of that.
Well, it's interesting, TCEQ being air and water, that they would have that recognition that, hey, we could have both going on simultaneously, couldn't we?
Yeah, there were reorgs that they had several reorgs that tried to kind of get everybody mixed together and actually house them in the same in the same offices and everything like that. Get them used to working with each other.
Yeah, I imagine that the multi-hazard lens or issue for TDIS will be one of our grand challenges for the life of TDIS, perhaps, right? Is knowing that it's important to manage and finding good ways to manage it are going to be really important for us. Yeah. And if we're doing it right, well, the thing is that we might have to just try some things to get going, right? And then figure out whether we're doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah. Well, any parting thoughts for us, Gordon?
Well, my thought is I'm going to have a reserve computer hot and ready the next time I do one of these. So I'll be logged on twice so I can just grab the other one and put it in the hot slot and continue with it as if nothing happened.
So, it's Murphy's Law. If you do that, Gordon, well, both of them will fail. And then you'll say you'll have to have a third computer.
I'll have my iPad then. Somehow I will kill this. That's my lesson learned for this particular presentation, is that they always have a hot swappable system that you can pull down immediately. No, I really enjoy the conversation that came out of this. I think it's valuable to talk through some of these problems that we don't often discuss in detail, and share our ideas and perspectives on different approaches to this. It's really helpful for everyone, I hope, but it's certainly helpful for me.
Indeed. Well, this will be one of many more conversations, I'm sure. So thank you again very much for being willing to come to talk to us about this. And we'll probably be inviting you back to continue the conversation. And you had mentioned that you had other folks, too, that you thought might externally be able to give us some other perspectives on the multi-hazard landscape. So I'll follow up with you. There was someone you'd mentioned to me, but I can't remember at the moment. But perhaps.
Yeah, I was probably thinking of some of the National Weather Service folks that are sitting beside me, or we're all sitting together in the State Operations Center when these things occur. They're getting the same range of questions asked to them, of course. Things that are not often considered, going into an event when some special situation arises, like you've got a flooded chemical plant that explodes and stays on fire and does things like that. That's
not what you expect.
Yep. Terrific. Well, thank you again. And to everyone else, if you have ideas of other talks you'd like to hear or topics you'd like to discuss, feel free to send those over to me. And thank you again, everybody, for participating today. And I wish you a great rest of your week. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gordon.
Thanks.